Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Rugby League Rookwood, the podcast where we unearth some of the great stories from the past in the world of rugby league. In each episode, what we'll do is we look at a player, a game, a ground, or any sort of quirky fact or story, which we hope you find both interesting and maybe a little bit educational as well. With me, I've got the Rugby League historian, Terry Williams.
G'day, Matt.
How are we?
Very well, thank you.
And what are we looking at today, Terry?
Okay, we might start off this week by looking at one of the greats from the pre-World War II era, Arthur Pony Halloway. Pony Halloway was born 17th of July 1885 in the inner city, and by the time rugby league starts in 1907, he's just starting to make his name. Obviously, he's 22 at that stage, so he's got his whole career in front of him, but he makes the big decision to switch over, and he's the halfback in those first games in 1907, plays in those games against Baskerville. So straight away, he's in the league camp and being ostracised from rugby union. And in 1908, he finds himself playing for Glebe in the competition there and gets selected for the first Kangaroo Tour. But he's on the move pretty much straight away. He's with Glebe in 1908, and then he goes to Balmain in 1909, 10, 11. And then he moves across to Eastern Suburbs, and that's largely because of the residential rule. And it was a good time to go across. He'd just come back from his second Kangaroo Tour, but the Roosters, or the Tricolours as they were known then, had won the premiership in 1911. And he certainly helps extend the run because he's the halfback and the linchpin in their side for the next few seasons. And they win both the 1912 and 1913 premierships with Pony at the halfback spot. After 1914, though, he switches back over to Balmain. And this is where things really start to come together for the Watersiders, as they were known, or the Tigers, as we would refer to them. So Balmain win the premiership in 1915, 16, 17, wow. And then again in 1919, 1920. So Pony's already built up a hell of a wardrobe of premiership blazers. And he's getting towards the end of his career then. He goes to Ipswich in 1921 and plays his last year as a player up there before he comes back to Sydney and he starts his coaching career. But we'll get to that in a moment because his record as a player is unbelievable. And some of the stories about him are quite legendary. Famously on the Kangaroo Tour, he was sent off for biting an opponent. And I think Dan Frawley was actually the person who was responsible largely for this incident because he told the opposition halfback that Halloway, whose other nickname was Grumpy, that he was notoriously rude and wouldn't talk to people. And then he said the same thing to Halloway about the opposition halfback. So they ran on the field looking at each other, shooting daggers. And then when they get the chance, they come to halt and it's on. They start belting one another. On the last tussle, Halloway's got two black eyes and so he finally gets the bloke and he starts biting him. The referee sends them both off and he's going, he's trying to bite my ear off. He's going, I would have bit your bloody head off if I had the chance. And Frawley's just standing on the wing apparently laughing his head off. I don't know if Pony was ever the wiser for it, but I suppose it's a testament to his toughness.
And his teeth.
And his teeth.
Rugby league and injuries, they go hand in hand. But Pony had a particular unique injury, didn't he?
Yeah, apparently he chopped the top of his finger off at work on the Saturday morning because, again, they're working class blokes. They're working on a Saturday morning before they play at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And he's chopped the top of from the last joint of the top of his finger off. So not just lacerated it, he's chopped it off.
Chopped it off.
So he just bandages it up. Whether it was stitched or not, I don't know. I'd hope so. To stem the flow of blood.
Maybe the Hessian sack or something.
Yeah, and then goes out and plays that afternoon. And I suppose, it certainly speaks on its own for toughness. Like it.
So would have turned up at the ground with blood coming.
You'd imagine so.
Good Lord.
I don't know if this was when he was playing for Glebe, the Dirty Reds. It wouldn't have been noticed on his jersey.
That's right. I would have mixed him with the jersey. That's right.
I suppose the highlight of his career, and he went on the two Kangaroo Tours, 1908 and 1911. As I say, he didn't get to play as much Test football in 1911 because McKivitt was the captain and the first choice halfback, and that was rightly so. But Pony wasn't too far behind him as a player. Probably not quite in the same league as McKivitt as a halfback, but certainly as a captain and as a leader and a mentor, he had a wonderful record. And he captained Australia on their successful tour to New Zealand in 1919. And as I say, he finished his playing career in Queensland. But when he comes back, he does stints with a few club teams, but most notably with Eastern Suburbs. He also had coaching stints with Newtown, with Western Suburbs, with Sydney Uni, and with Canterbury Bankstown. At Eastern Suburbs, he wins another 4 premierships to add to the 7 he's already won as a player. So in 1935, 36 and 37, and again in 45, he's the coach. So, and again, 1945, by that stage, he's 60 years of age, so he's not a young man, but an overall record of 11 premierships.
11 premierships.
That's something not even Wayne Bennett.
Well, I think Bennett's on seven.
Yes.
Seven premierships.
And, yeah. Gibson, obviously nowhere near close. The only one who probably could have got close was Norm Provan, who won 10 and was dudded one in, some might say, in 1978 when he was coaching.
That's yes. for another episode.
Yeah, but certainly, Pony Halloway's record speaks for itself, and it's a marvellous achievement that certainly stands the test of time and should be acknowledged, I'd say. He passed away on the 29th of January 1961, but never forgotten. So here's to you, Pony.
Well done, Pony, one of the great pioneers of our game. Now, Terry, I was walking around Balmain the other week and I stumbled upon this beautiful piece of real estate with goalposts on it, footy goalposts on it, right on the water. And I obviously come across Birchgrove Oval.
You're not the first bloke to stumble at Birchgrove Oval, Matt. I'll give you the tip. Yeah, Birchgrove is one of the venues that was first used by the New South Wales Rugby League in 1908. So they only had control of the three enclosed grounds, and Birchgrove is Balmain's home ground. Was very important to them. They also had Wentworth Park, and they had the Royal Agricultural Showground at Moore Park, which was the big venue for their main matches and their match of the round. But Birchgrove was very important to them to be able to at least have a venue that was close to the city, etc. And it should be pointed out at this stage too that when we talk about the city, that the layout of the city is very different to what we know it in 2024. So there's no harbour bridge.
Yeah.
For starters, the ownership of the car would be minimal. There would have been less than probably 100, 200 cars in the city at the time. And so the harbour is the freeway. It is the main traffic channel.
I was about to say, when you go there, there's a ferry wharf just near it.
Mm.
So supporters and I guess even players would have had to have caught ferry.
Very much so. And like for North Sydney, when they played North Sydney, it was everyone came
Absolutely,
across by boat.
Yeah.
That whole question of the harbour, from the officials' point of view too, when they were having meetings at the New South Wales Rugby League, they'd have to get home and get across the harbour, the guys from North Sydney, or even the guys from Balmain. You know, like it was a fair track back there.
Yeah.
So they'd have to go down to the quay and get the ferry there.
No Uber back then?
No Ubers back then, no.
Horse-drawn Uber.
Yeah, rickshaw perhaps. So that's the point, I suppose, that should be made. And so Balmain in 1908, it's their home ground, and it certainly benefits them in 1909, for example, nearly all their games were played at home at Birchgrove Oval, and that was one of the grievances they had when it came to the final, that they thought that it, not that it should have been played at Birchgrove, but they'd supported the league, and the league quite rightly pointed out, well, hang on, you've made some money out of this too, so.
Yep.
But they needed a successful club at that stage, the league, I suppose, is the point I'm trying to make there. But later on, Birchgrove, because it was a compact area and it was very much working class suburb then, because you had Cockatoo Island and you had the mine even was still functional at that stage down there.
Yeah.
So there's all these workers and waterside workers who are down there and they're living in those cottages. So it's a hotbed of working class sport.
It's a bit different now.
Pretty much different now. You might get attacked by a labradoodle rather than a stray miner. And the pubs are all cafes.
And the worst that's going to happen to you is you'll spill your cafe latte.
Yeah. But it very different back in 1908
and
in that period before the First World War. You've got all that sort of stuff going on. And that produces that crop of great Balmain footballers. And there was quite a few. There was, like a Birchgrove club that existed right up until those 60s, and a junior league club. So Birchgrove does the job pretty much for Balmain. They, as I say, they win the premierships in 1915 to 1920 and does the job for them as a home base and is regarded as their spiritual home until the end of 1929. And by that stage, you do have roads starting to open up.
Yeah.
You do have Sydney starting to spread out beyond Ashfield and beyond
western suburbs of Ashfield.
Yeah, beyond Bexley or beyond, like Newtown, Marrickville. So instead of those places being the end of the earth, they're all of a sudden starting to become in a city.
Yeah.
And so Balmain realised that they probably do need a bigger venue. There was a grandstand at Birchgrove back in those days, and there were certainly better change rooms than there are now. Again, they realised it wasn't viable. So they moved out of Birchgrove at the end of 1929. They actually spent 1930 at Wentworth Park, which was quite ironic given they'd stabbed Glebe in the back the year before and taken over the Dirty Reds' home ground. But then they went to Des Moines Oval firstly for a couple of seasons, and then in 1934 they moved to Leichhardt Oval, and that's pretty much been their home since. In 1942, they did go back to Birchgrove for their, and the last ever game there was played on the 8th of August 1942 when they beat North Sydney, and again they could have come across by boat even though the bridge was there at that stage, and Balmain won that one 17 points to 5. But as I say, Leichhardt since 1934 has been the home of the Balmain District Club at first grade level, and yet Birchgrove has been a very important part of the Balmain Junior League and the local community down there. And yeah, there's still a very strong sentiment there. Having coached in the Balmain Junior League for over 12 years, Matt, with Concord Burwood United, we've had a few good days there, and we had a few days that made it a nice place to get away from too. I must say, it was always a bugger of a place to find a car park when you're there on a Sunday morning.
Particularly if particularly when the tennis is on next door. There's a little tennis club there. But it's a beautiful ground. It's a great ground. And as I said, I was walking around there a couple of weeks ago, and there is a plaque there. Birchgrove Oval, the Australian Rugby League, to celebrate the centenary of Rugby League, put a plaque there, which acknowledges the two matches played on April the 20th, 1908, the opening day of Rugby League in Australia, where South Sydney defeated North Sydney 11-7 in the first game, then Balmain defeated Western Suburbs 24-0.
Yeah, and one other final, trivial fact for you, the road that leads down to there is called Ferdinand Street. And Birchgrove was actually the home of the Balmain Cricket Club for many years. And one of Australia's finest, certainly Balmain's finest cricketers, Archie Jackson, he lived in Ferdinand Street, just a stone throw from the Oval. And next door to him lived a famous rugby league figure, the second referee, Tom McMahon.
Okay.
In the terrace house next door. And both those homes are still there in number 14 and number 16, Ferdinand Street. So if you get down to Birchgrove, you can go and check it out. There's no plaque out the front of their place, but you can stop and pay your respects there too.
And I remember a couple of years ago, I think it might have been for the centenary of Rugby League, actually, to acknowledge its spiritual relevance. I think the Australian Rugby League had the season launched there. They had a big marquee on the ground.
Yeah, I was at that one, and was able to quaff a few free beers. So that's always good.
Beautiful. Great place. If you're ever around that area, check it out. Birchgrove, have a read of the plaques. It's a beautiful ground, and used that word just a couple of seconds ago. Very spiritual. So if you've got any memories of Birchgrove Oval or any stories about Birchgrove Oval or any other ground or oval that you think that we should maybe do a segment on, please contact us on the Facebook page at Rugby League Rookwood or at rugbyleaguerookwood@hotmail.com. In this next segment, we're going to look at a famous game in rugby league history, and today we're going to look at the 1911 Grand Final.
Yes, Matt. So this was the last year that this system of the Premiership was used. And remember, we talked a little bit about that in some of our other episodes. But basically, what happened was when they came around to the finals, that the competition's table was still live. So any points you won in finals matches counted towards the competition table. So that's how Newtown, for example, were able to win the 1910 Premiership when they had a draw with South Sydney, because they were 1 point ahead of South Sydney at the end of the Premiership. So that gives you some understanding of how the Premiership was working. So it wasn't first past the post, and it wasn't the guaranteed grand final. So in 1911, Glebe finished top of the Premiership ladder on 22 points ahead of Eastern Suburbs and South Sydney. And that meant that Eastern Suburbs and South Sydney had to play off in the semi-final to see who would face Glebe in the final. Remember, they're only 2 points, they're both behind. So when East beat South Sydney in that final, they go ahead to play Glebe, because if they beat Glebe, then they're drawn level with them on 22 points. Mm. And a grand final would be necessitated. And sure enough, on the 9th of September, the final was played between East and Glebe, and Eastern Suburbs triumph by 22 points to 9. So that sets up the first ever real grand final the following week. Now, a couple of points that should be made here. By this stage of the Premiership, the Kangaroos have gone away.
That's just amazing.
Well, they had to sail. So yeah, that's right. They've gone, say, in July. Yep. And
July.
They've taken, obviously, the cream of the footballers that from the Sydney Premiership, because that's when McKibbitt's team goes away and wins the Ashes, as we've touched on previously. But there were a couple of guys, famously, who didn't get to go on that tour, and they certainly are the stars of this game. Particularly for Eastern Suburbs, you've got a guy called Dally Messenger, and you've got a guy called Sandy Pierce, both Hall of Famers. And if you don't know Sandy Pierce, give yourself an uppercut. You certainly should, because he's not only one of the Roosters' greats, he's one of the league's greats, and probably the first great hooker in the game and the great hooker, I suppose, in that pre-World War II era. And just a marvellous fella to go with it by all accounts. So they'd knocked back the tour for various reasons. Messenger for marital reasons, and I think Sandy was too busy with work, basically. So they're on the Rooster side. And then on the Glebe side, you've got a 16-year-old kid by the name of Frank Bird, who's just started to come to prominence that year. And he was deemed too young to go on the Kangaroo Tour. But again, he's only a boy at this stage. So the two teams for the grand final lineup. In the Eastern Suburbs side, you've got Kinghorn fullback, you've got Barney Dalton on one wing, Denny Campbell in the centres with Messenger, and Denny Campbell was a fine player in his own right, who had a great career in England, and who's the grandfather of Lex Marinos' wife.
That's there you go.
Side. You've got Ted White on one wing. Herbie Collins is in the halves with Les Cody. Jersey O'Malley, a non-NOA Kangaroo, is in the pack with Sandy Pearce. Mick Frawley, another former Australian representative up front in the front row. Teddy Griffiths, Charlie Lees, representative forward in his own right. And Billy Dalton make up the pack. For the Glebe side, the Dirty Reds, you've got Bunny Algy at fullback. You've got Mickey McGovern on one wing and Chris Cubitt on the other wing. Dave Garlick and Tommy Gleeson. And Tommy Gleeson, again, he had a wonderful career in England, was where he played most of his football. And he was in that Huddersfield team of all talents that won all four trophies in 1914-15. So this is one of his swan song games in Australia. So he's there in the centres, as I say, with Garlick. In the halves, you've got Les Cubitt and Fritz Flinger Thiering, who was a noted amateur boxer and could certainly throw them, hence the nickname Flinger. In the forwards, you've got Sid Pert, again, another renowned hard man. Pony Redmond, Sammy Griffiths, who, if looks could kill, he's probably will. Son Birch is the captain, Frank Birch, the baby, and Harry Brighton make up the forwards. And although Glebe were overrun in the final, this game is far closer. And Glebe are actually doing the better until about 15 minutes to go, and that's often the deciding point in the second half of a grand final so many times in history. So here, Bunny Algy, the Glebe fullback, had caught the knock early on, and here there's a bomb, and he comes down, and he's unable to take it, and I suppose it's too hard to be critical of him for that because there's been plenty of guys like that, but certainly this drop is almost like a Ben Hunt moment or a Neville Glover sort of drop because it costs his team big time. All of a sudden, East grabbed the ball, White goes over to score, Daly kicks another goal, and East are ahead 9-8 as time's running out. And Messenger adds another one. And Chris Cubitt had scored two tries for Glebe. They'd scored two tries to one. And yet they end up getting beaten 11-8. And it's the closest the Glebe ever came to winning a premiership. And it was the only time that, apart from 1922, that they got to a grand final. In 1922, they faced Norse in the final. But if the system had been in place, if not the system from 1912, when the City Cup starts and it's first past the post, is automatically the premier. There's no finals. If that had been in place in 1911... Glebe are the premiers. And I wonder if the fact that they had won the premiership in 1911, if that would have... Yeah, well, if that meant... Well, I don't know if they'd still be in the premiership. No, I'm not going to go that far. It's like saying if Newtown won in 1981, would they have survived the Super League War? No, I don't know. They wouldn't. I don't know the Glebe would either. But it would have made it, I think, a little bit more difficult for the New South Wales Rugby League and the Balmain Backstabbers in 1929 and the South Sydney and Roosters ones.
Hey, going too far there.
No, they were all in on it. Yeah, it was like Julius Caesar. But anyway, that's another episode, and we can talk about 1929. But poor old Glebe, that was the closest they ever came to winning a title. So, c'est la vie.
If you're at the 1911 Grand Final or have any memories about the Glebe Club, did you have a relative that played for the Glebe Club? Did you indeed play for the Glebe Club? Contact us at Rugby League Rookwood on the Facebook or at Rugby League Rookwood at hotmail.com. Our next segment, we love this segment, Quirky Corner. Rex had Controversy Corner, Matt and Terry have Quirky Corner. Must be quirky sort of guys, I guess. What have we got this week?
Matt, I thought I'd get you to read this little excerpt from the wonderful book that was put together by Ian Heads and Dave Middleton. I think it was the Roosters book, From Where the Sun Rises, because they tell the story in its own beautiful style. So I'll just get you to read this little section from page 88, it is.
The headline is, Barney Dalton, Such a Crime. In 1931, Wally Webb recorded a spectacular try from 1912, which began when the ball was knocked out of South Herb Gilbert's hands by, in Webb's words, the late Barney Dalton bumping into him. Bernard Barney Dalton had been late, but hardly lamented since November 9, 1929, when he was shot and killed outside the Strand Hotel on the corner of William and Crown Streets, Darlinghurst. He had been a member of notorious crime figure Kate Lee's gang, and as Larry Ryder explains in Razor, had been in trouble for prostitution, drug and sly grog selling, offensive behaviour and robbery. Ryder tells how Lee had offered Dalton and another of her bodyguards, Wally Tomlinson, big money to kill two crooks from her rivaling crime, Tilly Devine's mob, as payback for the murder of one of her men. Devine's henchmen knew they'd been targeted and planned on retaliating first. This was the ugly, seedy reality of the East Sydney underworld in the late 20s. No wonder more respectable types deserted the inner city for quieter crimes away from the mayhem and closer to the surf. On what proved to be his final afternoon, Dalton was drinking at the Strand with associates, many of whom had also been in trouble with the law. At the 6 p.m. closing, he and Tomlinson stepped out into the footpath and were promptly cut down by bullets fired from a long-barreled revolver. Dalton's heart was punctured, his mate was seriously wounded, but while there were plenty of witnesses and two of Devine's gangsters, her husband, Big Jim Devine, and the little gunman, Frank Green, were subsequently charged. No one was ever convicted over the attack. The weekly Sydney tabloid, Truth, covered the bloodshed in extraordinary detail, painting grim but vivid pictures of Dalton's wait at his home at Woolloomooloo and Green's trial, retrial, and eventual acquittal through lack of evidence. Barney Dalton played in two of East Premiership winning sides, 1911 and 1912, but there is no mention of his demise in the club's 1930 annual report.
Yeah, there you go, eh, Barney? Who'd have thought rugby league and the actual charges were, what was it?
He's got prostitution, quite a CV.
Drug and sly drug selling, offensive behaviour and robbery. I don't know what's the offensive behaviour. What could be worse than all the other stuff? So
maybe showed his knees at Bondi Beach when he was bathing after hours.
Keeping his hat on when he walked into the RSL or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
and some big names in there away from rugby league. I mean, we got Tilly Devine and Kate Lee.
Yes, very well-known figures. And so if Barney's associating with them and he's in the employ of one of those ladies, then yes, it's no wonder that he was known to the police. And I've told you many, many times, Matt, that the eastern suburbs is a bad place. It's a notorious hotbed for crime. And it's been going on, you know, since 1788, I'd suggest.
Now, the Strand Pub, I don't think the Strand Pub's there anymore.
Yeah, I think it is on William Street. And that was actually where the late Malcolm Andrews, who was a great journalist and author, he used to write a column in the English newspapers, rugby league newspapers over there called View from the Strand, which he would give his interpretation. The thing was, Malcolm was penning the column while he was living in England. So the characters that he had, that he was drinking at the Strand with, were largely in his head. Mind you, I think Malcolm did enjoy his fair share of schooners at the Strand over the years because he was a lovely fella and was known to be partial to a drop of Reshes, I'd suggest.
Well, just the other thing too here, 6 p.m. closing.
Yeah, yes. And look, if you're going to go out, I suppose an afternoon on the Terps isn't a bad way to spend your final few hours then, is it? The thing that also gets me about it and shows the nature of the underworld and gangster influence is the fact that there was all these witnesses and no one was able to testify. It's happened at certain functions, I know, in Sydney when there's been 1,200 people in the bathroom all at the one time when something took place. So an amazing coincidence and,
If anyone's interested in paying their respects to Barney Dalton, he's buried at the Botany Catholic Cemetery. So not Rookwood, actually our competitors, but next time you're at the Botany Catholic Cemetery, I think it might be called Eastern Suburbs Cemetery now, you might want to have a look for the grave of Barney Dalton and pay respects.
Another rugby league figure that's buried at Botany is Dally Messenger, but I don't think Dally was involved in any of these sort of shenanigans. So if you go out to a Botany Cemetery, though, you can visit both.
Well, that concludes episode 6 of Rugby League Rookwood. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you've learned something. Don't forget, anything at all that you want to get in contact with us about, give us feedback, requests, whatever it is, rugbyleaguerookwood@hotmail.com, Facebook, and as we say at the end of every episode, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme.
Or you can send us a telepathic message if you want, but you knew I was going to say that.